In Matthew 23, we have some information as far as the condemnation of the scribes and Pharisees. And leading up to verse 8, Jesus talked about in verse 4, they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne. They lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with their finger. They loaded the people up with different religious rules, different religious traditions. They, though, were not willing to abide by what they themselves, others, were supposed, what others they said were supposed to do. Then when we come down to verse 8, he talks about religious titles. He says, but be ye not called rabbi, for one is your teacher, and all ye are brethren. And call no man your father on the earth, for one is your father, even he who is in heaven. Neither be ye called masters, for one is your master, even the Christ. But he that is greatest among you shall be your servant. And whosoever shall exalt himself shall be humbled, and whosoever shall humble himself shall be exalted. One of the things that helps us understand, this is where we left off last week, is when Jesus uses this Father, this word Father, what he means. When you look at what goes before the word Father, what word do you find?
Your.
Okay, I was thinking about a religious title. In verse 8, what do we find? Don't be called rabbi. A religious title. A religious title comes before the word Father. After Jesus uses the word Father, do we find another religious title?
Teacher.
All right, teacher. Some translations would use a different word, and we'll talk about why the word's different. Some translations would use the word master. On both sides of the word Father, you have a religious title used. That being the case, that would suggest that when you look at the word sandwiched between these two religious words, Father, it's probably also a religious word, it's probably also a religious title. If this is not enough, then Jesus makes the point even more clear, distinct in this way. He says, when we think about this word Father, how many fathers are there? There's just one. Well, if he's speaking about a biological father, that doesn't make any sense. But if he's thinking about father in the sense of a spiritual father, how many are there? There is only one. Then when we look at the word called, it's a word that describes the attribution of a particular rank. So once again, it's a third way to demonstrate that Jesus is talking about a religious title. We said last week that sometimes people will look at this particular passage and say, well, it's okay to use the word father as a religious title because Jesus also used the word teacher. If we're willing to use the word teacher, we should not object to people also using the word father. Where we left off was, this is not a good argument for a couple of reasons. First of all, when people use the word teacher, is it really a religious title in our day and time? Or is it a title like rabbi, an exalted title? No. Teacher is a description of function. It's what we do. We also made this point. Could there be an atheist teacher? Yes. Many times the word teacher is completely independent. It has no religious connotation whatsoever. So when we look at the word teacher, when we look at the word father, they are definitely not equal terms. There is also this point, and we mentioned this a moment ago based on what Lois had. Some translations we use the word teacher. Some other translations we use the word master. The reason for that is that when we look at our Greek manuscripts, there are some passages where the manuscripts use different words. For example, today if we had 10 copies of the Declaration of Independence, we might, as we were reading down through that document, if it had been transcribed by different people over the years, it might say, we the people, we the population. Well, you have different words there. Now, the words could be synonymous, or it could be a case where those words have two different connotations. When we go back and we look at the manuscripts that we have from Matthew 23, verse 8 and 9, we have some manuscripts which use the word teacher. It is the didaskalos is the word. It's the regular word for teacher. There are also some manuscripts which have a different word, and if you have a version which uses the word master, the ASV, the New King James, the New American Standard, I think, will all use the word master. The King James and the New International Version will use the word teacher. This word that's translated teacher is a separate word. It's a distinct term. The only time that we find it will be in Matthew 23. The information there in verse 9 and also verse 10. Jesus says in verse 10, neither be ye called masters. Then what's he say? For how many masters do you have? There's only one. So if Jesus used this word master instead of teacher, and we're not sure which word would be right because the manuscripts do vary here, then that argument, well, teacher is equivalent to father, that just goes out the window. Because if it's this word master, this particular word has the sense of, let me give you the formal definition here that I had for it. Leadership and guidance. One source said in verse 10 it means there's only one teacher who should be trusted, only one guide for the spiritual life. So if it's this word, it means far, far more than teacher. Jesus was not describing a teacher in our sense of the word. Anything that you want to add or ask before we run a couple cross-references here? All right, in thinking about religious titles, I want to show you some other things. Two of these items come from the book of Revelation, Revelation 22, also Revelation 19, verse 10, and then we'll go back for a third reference to the book of Job. We'd like to have ready for us in just a minute, Revelation 22, verse 9. Revelation 22, verse 9, Sherman, Lois, and this is going to be Lois Craw, if you'll pick up from Revelation, Revelation 19, verse 10. Our Old Testament reference is going to be Job 32. Verses 21 and 22. Betty, I saw your hand first. Job 32, verses 21 and 22. Steve, we'll get you for the next reference, please. All right. The point that I want to make is that when it comes to religious titles, these titles that exalt someone or something, only God is worthy of this exaltation. Let's start. Revelation 22, verse 9. Okay.
Then he said to me, "See that you do not do that, for I am your fellow servant and of your brethren, prophets, and of those who keep the words of this book, worship God."
Okay. Notice this point. The prophets are being described. Would you say that the prophets were great men? You're spokesman for God. Even though the word prophet is described, they are called brethren. You would expect that if anyone was deserving of a lofty religious title, the prophets would have been in that group. The prophets, though, are simply one of the brethren. They had different functions. Their task was somewhat different than what others did, but they were still brethren. It's perfectly consistent with what we find here in Matthew 23. So it would be a great cross-reference if you can make that note. Matthew 22, verse 9, even prophets are called brethren. Then we come over to Revelation chapter 19 and look at the information in verse 10.
This is a New American Standard.
All right.
"Then I fell at his feet to worship him, but he said to me, 'Do not do that. I am a fellow servant of yours and your brethren who hold the testimony of Jesus. Worship God, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy.'"
An angel is under consideration here. Are angels greater than men? Yes, they are. Yet even though angels are greater than men, as this angel has contact with John, he says to John, "I want you to know that I, an angel, am a fellow servant." If angels that are greater than men do not qualify for a lofty or religious title, they are simply the servants, fellow servants of God, what about all people on earth? We do not deserve a title. Preachers, elders, we can be described as the deacons, Bible class teachers, we can be described by function, but the lofty religious titles that are so prominent in the religious world, they are completely out of place. Then Job 32, verses 21 and 22. Betty, this information is from Elihu, one of Job's friends, probably the first book that was written very, very early in Bible history, yet even he understands this particular point.
"Let me not, I pray you, respect any man's person, neither will I give flattering titles unto any man, for I know not to give flattering titles, else would my maker soon take me away." American Standard.
Okay. Elihu said, people use them? Is God pleased? No. So, whether we look at the New Testament, the Old Testament, we come out with this same point. Rather than exalt ourselves, Jesus, as we come to the end of this section, Matthew 23, verses 11 and 12, he says, if you want to be great, be what?
Humble.
You need to be humble. You need to be someone who is willing to be a servant. He said, if you exalt yourself, if you try to lift yourself up, if you are someone who is filled with pride, self-admiration, the Lord said, you're going to be struck down. you're going to be unexalted, if you will. But the person who's willing to humble himself, Jesus says that individual is going to be exalted. This teaching is so important. It is found repeatedly in the life of Jesus. It's found throughout the New Testament. Romans 12, verse 16. 1 Timothy 6, verse 17. James 4, verse 10. 1 Peter 5, 6. It's used again and again and again. When we see this word servant, what's it remind you of? Jesus says we need to be a servant of others.
So,
okay, I think that would be one of the things that comes to mind. What about the word deacon? The word that's translated servant here is also translated deacon in 1 Timothy chapter 3, two times, 1 Timothy 3 verse 8, and also 1 Timothy chapter 3 verse 12. When we think about deacons, we think, well, yes, he's a servant. When we look at what Jesus says, though, in Matthew 23, what else is he telling us? Hey, sure, the deacons, they need to serve, but so does everybody else. Our service may be in some less specific ways, but we still have, if we want to be a child of God, the need to serve. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with Matthew 23, verses 13 and 14? Okay. The information in verse 13 says, "But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because ye shut the kingdom of heaven against men, for ye enter not in yourselves, neither suffer ye them that are entering in to enter." If you have some Bibles, like the American Standard Translation, you'll see that you go immediately from verse 13 to verse 15. Verse 14 is not on the text, but it'll probably be in the footnote. In the ESV, the footnote says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye devour widows' houses, even while for a pretense ye make long prayers. Therefore ye shall receive the greater condemnation." Then in verse 15, going back into the text, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye compass sea and land to make one proselyte. And when he has become so, ye make him twofold more a son of hell than yourselves." The word woe. What comes to mind when you see that word? Woe! Good news or bad? It's bad news. It's an exclamation. It's an interjection. It's a way of saying, this is bad news. In this case, it's a way of introducing doom and wrath. Old Testament prophets sometimes use this. You would find it back in passages like Isaiah chapter 3, verse 11, when there was a people, God's people, maybe another nation. They were unrepentant. They decided that they were going to pursue unrighteousness. God's prophet would say, "Whoa!" That would be God's message to say bad times are on the horizon. As you look at verses 13 through 39, 20 plus verses here, you have this interjection "woe" being used eight times. That's a lot of times to use the word "woe" in 20 plus verses. So it's one more indicator that when we come to this section of Matthew 23, Jesus is talking to and about the scribes and the Pharisees. He really comes down very, very hard on these people. If you look ahead a little bit, verse 13 is going to be one of the places where you see this word "hypocrite" introduced, and it just comes through again and again and again. One of the things that kind of fascinates me, and it's a good lesson for today, as Jesus deals with these men, does he engage in personal attacks? He doesn't. When we see people today dealing with an issue, oftentimes it's not a discussion that's based on the issue, it's a discussion that's based on personal attacks. You know, "You did this to me way back when." Or, "There's this," or "This, there's this." Jesus dealt with the facts, specifically what these men were doing and what they were teaching. He avoids personal attacks, and this is still a good strategy for us. He introduced the fact in verses 3 through 7 that these fellows were not living in the right way. They were guilty of hypocrisy. If you go back and you kind of scan the information there, he said they sat in the place of authority, Moses' seat. You know, they taught some things, they used the scriptures, but we mentioned the heavy burdens that they tried to bind on people, the works they did. He said all their works, verse 5, they're done to be seen of men. They put on the religious show, the phylacteries. As far as what they were wearing, either on their arm or around their head, the scriptures in these leather pouches, we talked about that. The borders of the garments designed to remind them about God's commandments. They enlarged those to make them stand out more. They wanted the chief places, the chief seats at the entities when they were out in the marketplaces, the agora. They wanted to be called by prominent religious titles, all of this stuff. And Jesus said, you're not living in the right way. Now he turns to really some formal curses. He begins this section, verse 13, by referring to the kingdom of heaven. He makes two charges. Number one, he says, concerning the kingdom of heaven, what have you fellows done? All right, you shut it up. You've put a lock on it. Kind of, if you can think of padlocking something. That's what Jesus says you've done to the kingdom of heaven. Well, this kingdom of heaven, it's used in different ways, but if we kind of offer a summary definition for it, what would it describe? A relationship with God, God's kingdom, salvation, all of these things. So if you take salvation and you put a lock on the door, what have you done? You've shut everybody out. Jesus makes two points. He says, not only have you shut everybody else out, but what have you done with yourselves? Even you, individually, are not headed here. It's almost like if you can imagine a building that has something that's very desirable, you have a lot of people outside that are trying to get inside the door. But folks have bolted the door, they've locked the door, they've shut the windows, they've done everything that they can to keep people out. That's the image that Jesus is offering for the scribes and the Pharisees. It's kind of odd, isn't it? These fellows were supposed to do what when it came to God? Point people to Him. Teach them about God. Show them the right way to go. Jesus comes along and says, you have locked up the kingdom of heaven. You're not permitting people to enter. When he describes this, he actually uses the present tense. When we look at the verb that's translated shut or locked, it's used more than a dozen times in the New Testament. And this is just kind of a side point from our Revelation class. Remember Revelation chapter 3, verses 7 and 8? Jesus says, there's a door. I've opened it. Who can shut it? Nobody. And he says, if I've shut the door, who can open it? Nobody. So it's the same kind of image. You've got this shut, this locked imagery. And Jesus makes it clear that these fellows were really on the wrong path. A couple of the points before we get going too far, but we'll take Steve's thought here.
I know it starts out here condemning and saying, woe, W-O-E, which is sorrow. That you could almost, maybe I'm off. You could say, whoa, W-H-O-A, like, whoa, stop.
Right.
It's like, stop, but they kept going and went too far.
Yeah.
They did these things, this, that, and the other. Not that stopping all to itself would have been right. There's the right way or wrong way to do things, but they knew it, and yet they didn't stop. They continued on and got deeper and deeper.
They went the second mile, the third mile, the fourth mile. You're right. That woe would have been good advice. But these fellas had gone to the point where now it's W-O-E, this interjection, where you fellas have just gone off the cliff. You're exactly right. Don?
Do you think they knew they were going off the cliff?
Paul talks about in the book of Romans. Let's go back here. He's talking about the Jewish people. I believe it's Romans chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Let's take a look at Romans 2. He says, wherefore, thou art without excuse, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest, for wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself. For thou that judgest dost practice the same things. And we know that the judgment of God is according to truth against them that practice such things. He says, I was looking for the statement that talks about, you say that it's wrong to steal, and you steal. Maybe that's, is it where?
21.
Okay, is it in 221? Yes, okay. I just needed to go down a little further. Thank you. He talks about in verse 20, he says, the Jewish people, they regarded themselves as a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of babes, having in the law the form of knowledge and of truth, which would be consistent with what we have here in Matthew chapter 23. He says in 21, thou therefore that teachest another, teachest not thyself. Thou that preachest a man should not steal, dost thou steal? Thou that sayest a man should not commit adultery, dost thou commit adultery? Thou that abhorrest idols, dost thou rob temples? When we look at what Paul said about the Jewish people, and he may not have necessarily been thinking about the same group that Jesus was thinking about, but they're both in the first century, they're both talking about the same group of people, so there would seem to me to be at least some overlap. When we think about what he says here, you tell somebody it's wrong to steal. Then you go out and steal. it's almost impossible for me to imagine how people cannot connect the dots. Now, a little later in Matthew 23, we're going to see that the Jews, they really tried to split some fine hairs, which in essence didn't exist. But they tried to say, well, we've made a promise, but we don't have to keep it because our promise was made under these circumstances. If the circumstances had been different, then we would have been obligated to keep the promise. But since we've got this way out, we don't have to do it. Now, maybe that's what they were trying to do here in Romans chapter 2 and Romans chapter 3. But if they, you know, people can believe anything they want to believe. They will tell themselves somehow this is okay. They'll rationalize it in one way or another. And that's apparently what these people did. But if they had just stopped to use Steve's word earlier, the woe, W-H-O-A, and hold of the horse for a couple minutes and looked at what they were saying and really looked at what the scriptures were teaching, they would have realized that what they were doing was terribly wrong. But they didn't, so Jesus comes along with this woe, W-O-E, as an interjection. Any follow-up on that or anything else? All right, well, let's think about why Jesus is able to say what he does. A few years prior to this time, we have John the Baptist showing up. Remember, one of John the Baptist's great messages was, repent, turn. You're involved with what's wrong. You need to embrace what's right. Matthew chapter 3, verses 5 through 6. Now, if these fellas, and Jesus comes along, he's presenting himself as the living water and so forth, John chapter 4, verse 10, he's the bread of life, John chapter 6, verse 35. If these scribes and these Pharisees had not accepted Jesus, and they had rejected John the Baptist's testimony, but they hadn't gone out and tried to undo what Jesus and John were doing, would that have been bad? If they just rejected the testimony of Jesus and John, would that have been bad? Yeah, it would have been bad. But these fellows were not content to just reject what Jesus and John had said. What did they want to do? We're not only going to reject it, we're going to try to overthrow it. We're going to try to keep other people from not understanding or not believing, not accepting the work by these fellows. So they took their sin and they actually compounded it. We think, for example, back in John chapter 9, verse 22. Let's flip over there for a second. This is the place where we read about this fella. He'd been healed of blindness. And after he's healed, he's asked about things. His parents are asked about things. Remember from John 9:22 what the Jews did. These things said his parents, they said back there in verse 21, you know, we don't know how he's able to see now, who opened his eyes. You know, he's an adult. He can speak for himself. You go ask him. Verse 22 said, his parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had agreed already that if, notice this, any man should confess him to be the Christ, he should what? Let's put him out of the synagogue. We're going to do our best to shut down Jesus, to get rid of the testimony of John the Baptist, and eliminate everything related to Jesus, unless it's unfavorable information. So when Jesus comes down in giving the condemnation against these people here in Matthew chapter 23, we can see why he did that, because they just continue to compound the wrongs. In verse... Oh, Don?
Paul was a Pharisee.
He had been?
And apparently he believed everything that he was taught to do until he had... wrote the message.
Right.
So either he knew that they were stealing and doing all these other things, like you said in Romans, or at that time he was blind to it. Yeah. So it took a miracle for him
to see.
To repent.
Yeah.
See.
I would be hesitant to say that all the Pharisees were headed in the wrong direction. We think about Nicodemus back in John 3. He was a Pharisee. From what I can tell, he apparently was someone with a good heart. But today you have the same kind of thing. If you are in an area where you have a bunch of slum landlords, you might find 1% or 2% of the landlords that are really trying to do what's right. But for the most part, when you look at that area, you would say that the landlords in this area are really out for themselves. They do not care about the people that they rent to. And the same thing would probably be true for the scribes. There probably were a few of them that were good, but for the most part, it was just pervasive wickedness, so the good guys got swallowed up in the bad. When you look at Paul, I'd like to think that he really, you know, he said he was a Pharisee of the Pharisees when he wrote to the Philippians. From that, I would guess that he probably was trying to do what was right, but still, that zeal, he says, was misdirected. But it is good to think about him and others and realize that there were a few who were trying to do what was right, but the majority were corrupt. Anybody else? Okay, let's talk about verse 14. That may or may not be, as I said, in the main section of your Bible. It might be footnoted. But it's footnoted because of a manuscript variation. Jesus, as he talks about these fellas, to show how wicked they are. Verse 14 says, they devoured the houses of widows. A couple quick points. Here is a place where the verb tense would be significant. When he says, you're devouring the houses, what would you guess about the verb tense? It's ongoing. It's present tense. Would it have been bad if they'd done this once or twice? Four or five times? Yes. I mean, almost unspeakable. But it's like, maybe this is too strong, but it would almost be like somebody today scanning, and I've heard of people who are in the used car business. They will look in the obituaries, looking for some woman who's now by herself, thinking, well, she probably has a vehicle to sell. So let's go down and see if we can give her a little, you know, for a vehicle and maybe get it half price. So people still do that same kind of thing today when it comes to someone who's lost a mate. So these fellas, they're pictured as always looking for some kind of opportunity to find a woman who was in a difficult situation and see if they could take advantage of her. Jesus said that they devoured houses. Now, if you understood this literally, what would it mean? They start with a roof and just kind of eat down, like the gingerbread house. Here, though, you have a metonymy. You say one thing, but you mean something else. They devour the house, present tense. What's that mean? They're consuming her property. They're going out there and trying to get her assets, which, as I mentioned, is sometimes still done by people today. In our day and time, if a lady becomes a widow, a man becomes a widower, what is true of the financial state? All right, they're going to inherit everything, so you do have some cases where somebody is going to struggle, but you also have some other cases with life insurance and pensions and other things where a person is not completely independent or completely dependent. They are not penniless. In the first century, though, if you became a widow, what was your lot? You didn't have the First Jerusalem Bank life insurance policy, did you? The social networks that we have now, Social Security and some other things, it just didn't exist. So if you were a widow, the picture would be here with this word, neediness, destitution, poverty. One Bible illustration of that. Remember the widow? Jesus is at the temple treasury. He sees this widow. She comes along. She casts in how much? Two mites. Well, that's not a lot of money, but the important part of that is it was all she had. So when you think about the picture of widowhood from that passage, others in the New Testament, you find that, you know, they really did not have a lot. In some cases, a widow may have had what in the first century? All she had. Her house. That was it. Maybe husband had, you know, done everything that was necessary to make sure that there was, you know, no payment somehow associated with that. But these fellows, these scribes and Pharisees were thinking, well, hey, nice piece of property. Maybe the house wouldn't be worth anything, but remember the Old Testament story about the vineyard? Nice piece of land over there. We don't want the house, but let's see if we can go ahead and get that prime piece of property. We're not told exactly what the scribes and Pharisees did with these widows, but one source suggested this idea, and I think it's probably a pretty good suggestion. He said, the Pharisees or the scribes deprive widows of their houses as compensation for prayers offered for them. That, to me, when you look at what's being said here, makes a lot of sense. As you look at verse 14, maybe something that reinforces this explanation would be the kind of prayer that Jesus describes. He says, what kind of prayers are being offered? They were long prayers. So it may have been, I'm going to pray for you. I'm going to pray for you a lot. I'll pray for you very hard. But in return for that, give me the mortgage for the house. I'm going to pray that God's going to help you and see you through this difficult time. This certainly would have been, I think, appealing to a lot of people, but it would have cost people a lot. When you consider this point, too, we have the Pharisees, but we also have the scribes indicted by Jesus. Do you remember what we've said about the scribes? What did they do? They were the fellows that were involved with documents. When we think about today, documents, who draws up documents? The lawyers do. The attorneys do. It may be that when these scribes or these lawyers were working, especially with the widows, that perhaps they drew up some kind of legal document. Oh yes, we'll go ahead and draw things up, and we'll go ahead and pray for you. Then if there are any questions, hey, we're the expert, we're the attorney. Want to take it down to court and litigate it? We'll go ahead and be glad to see you in court. So a lot of different possibilities here, but in the end, I think they probably all come out to the same thing. Then you may have this consideration, and today this is still something that we see. If you have these charlatans doing what is described, and then they offer what kind of prayer? A long prayer, maybe super spiritual. People will say, oh, I can't imagine that he would do this because have you heard him pray? Today we hear that same kind of thing sometimes. I can't believe that a man of the cloth would do this. Same kind of stuff. So when we see what's taking place in our day and time, we do have a lot of parallels, it seems, to Matthew chapter 23. We do know, based on what Jesus said, that there were some people who were using prayer as a pretense, that is, a false motive for prayer. This is interesting, because it suggests, among other things, that God knows the motive for what we do. Do you think today there's still some people who pray from a false motive, a bad motive? You think there's some people who come to worship for a false motive? It's a matter of pretense? Yeah. Just about anything associated with Christianity can involve pretense. People do it. Maybe they go through the motions very well, but it is not for the right reason. We find this hinted at earlier in Jesus' life. Remember Matthew chapter 6, verse 5, where Jesus, as he was talking about prayer, he said, some pray, but they pray to be seen of men. Why did they pray? Performance. Let's go ahead and put on a show. Today, some people still worship in this particular way. I want to look at a couple of passages, cross-references. Let's see, Betty or Stevie, we're next. If you'll get Luke 15, verse 13, and in just a minute after that, we'll ask somebody to read Acts 2, verse 39. Acts 2, verse 39. Alisa, okay. Acts 2, 39 and Luke 15, 13. Both of these words also use this word long. So when we talk about long prayers, for us, we'll just throw it out in the form of a question. We say somebody prayed a long time today. How long is a long time if we think about prayer in a public assembly?
4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think about 5 minutes. Most people say, wow, we never thought the prayer was going to end. All right, let's take a look at the word long to kind of give us maybe a better idea of what was being done by these scribes and Pharisees. Steve, Luke 15, 13.
And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeying to a far country.
Okay, now here you probably wouldn't immediately suspect it's the same word, but far and long, same word. He goes into a long country, far away. Think he's going to make it there in 5 minutes? No, it's going to take a good while to get there. Now also look at Acts chapter 2, verse 39. Elisa?
For to you is the promise, and to your children, and to all that are afar off, even as many as the Lord our God shall call unto now.
Okay, the people who are afar off, way out there. There's one source that said the Jews, when it came to long prayers, prayed for 3 hours. Now, can you imagine a 3-hour prayer? Can you imagine, you know, if you were a widow and somebody said, I'm going to pray for you for a long time, 3 hours. When I was in Russia, I had some Russians pray for me. They thought I was sick. I was turning yellow. And it was about midnight. They didn't tell me exactly what was going on, but it was guess I must have had the look of death, because they all got some chairs and we sat around in a circle and they prayed for about an hour. Well, about midnight, you know, I was getting ready for bed, you know. We'll see if I'm still here in the morning. But it was a long prayer. But I don't think I've ever been in a situation where people prayed longer than that. Sometimes people might come together for a Bible class evening and say, we're going to have a prayer session. But when you think about what's being described here, it really must have been some show. One other quick cross-reference, and this one I think we can remember from memory. Proverbs chapter 28, verse 9, talking about the prayer of an unrighteous person. God says that kind of prayer is an abomination to him. Many times I think people think, well, God's going to accept, he's going to respond to any prayer, but there are some prayers which God says they really nauseate me, they make me sick. The end of verse 14, and then we'll see if there's anything else that you want to add or ask. Let's look at that one more time. There Jesus talks about the greater condemnation. He says, therefore ye shall receive the greater condemnation. He did not say who would engage in this condemnation. He did not also specify what it would be. to me, the most logical explanation of this would be that we're back to the subject of whether or not there will be degrees of rewards and punishment in eternity. Not everybody agrees about that particular topic. Here, though, it seems to me that Jesus is saying that in eternity there will be a difference as far as what people receive as far as punishment. When you think about a person who has not only cheated people, but they have cheated someone, they have deceived someone who is the least able to defend themselves in society. In this case, a first century widow. What would you say about the condemnation for that person? You need to really have a sock to you, or let's just let you off easy? Well, our sense of justice would seem to suggest that this person is someone who really needs to be punished and punished severely. We do know that greater is an adjective and it means extraordinary, profuse, abundant. So Jesus is saying this punishment is going to be extraordinary, it's going to be abundant. It's the same word that's used in John 10:10 where Jesus said, I've come to give life and I've come to give it abundantly. We do the same kind of thing right now. When we think about the Colorado shooting, people have said, well, hey, let's not lock him up for a year or 10 years, depending on what we get as far as feedback from the victim's family. What might we do? He deserves... all right, at least life and maybe the death sentence. I mean, he deserves the worst that we can possibly give him. Anything you want to add or ask before we pick up with the information in verse 15? All right. Jesus says, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye compass sea and land to make one proselyte. And when he has become so, ye make him twofold more a son of hell than yourselves. Based on this information, would you say that the scribes and the Pharisees were evangelistic? Yeah. They were great when it came to evangelism. Jesus said, you've gone out where to evangelize? You've gone out to the sea. You've gone out to the land. Well, what does that tell us about their evangelistic work? They left no stone unturned. These fellows were out looking for someone that was willing to become one of the people. Now, when we think about evangelistic efforts today, who are we trying to reach? Christians or non-Christians? We're trying to reach the lost. We're trying to reach non-Christians. For these Jews, were they trying to reach Jews or non-Jews? You think so? They were looking, I think, for other Jews. And they were looking for these people not to convert them to Judaism, but they were looking for these Jews that they could convert to... that's right. The Phariseeism. The scribes. And this is why Jesus said, instead of bringing these people to a state of salvation, you're bringing them to a state of condemnation. They're actually going to be lost. When he talks about your compassing land and sea, he uses the present tense to describe this activity. Jesus says, after you have gone out, you found these people, you've taught them, they've embraced your doctrine, what's the consequence? They become twofold more a child of hell. Well, what's that say about these fellas? They were a child of hell. These fellows were already in the devil's grip. So when these fellows, who are part of Satan's dominion, they go out, they reach someone, they bring him back, they indoctrinate that individual with their teaching. Jesus said, this person that you've converted is actually worse off than you are. How could that be true? Okay. Coupled with that, I think you now have this individual. He's a carbon copy of these Pharisees and scribes. But what about their own religious ideas? They're also there too. So they already had their error. You know, today when we think about converting people, we're saying, okay, you have some ideas, some philosophies, you have a way of life that's right or wrong. It's wrong. You need to change it. But with these fellas, it doesn't seem like it was so much you've got to get rid of your ideas. It's just, hey, you need to make sure that you follow us. We're not turning you to the truth. We're turning you to Phariseeism. So Jesus said the converts of the scribes and the Pharisees, they were going to fare worse. That's expressed by the word twofold. One source said, since Jewish converts out-Pharisee'd the Pharisees, the guilt of any convert was increased, and thus was the basis for greater punishment. And then another source said, the most converted were the most perverted. That's right. Today that same thing still happens when we find people who are not converted to the truth. Anything you want to add or ask over that verse or something else that we've said? Dolores?
I just wanted to ask something. Did you say that the Pharisees were more likely to try to convert Jews instead of Gentiles?
I think so. When he uses the word proselyte there, it would be, let's go ahead and take you. And because for them, they already had some background, some connections there to the Old Testament law. So let's bring them in and convince them. When you go back there to the Moses seat information beginning at the beginning of the chapter, maybe that was one of the things that they were trying to do, to go ahead and bring them to, you know, their traditions. They weren't willing to lift a finger, but let's get these people in here so that we can have true disciples.
Were they looking for, you know, when they talked about robbing the widows of their houses and then taking the money themselves instead of putting it in the temple? That's why I was wondering about the Gentiles. It seemed like that would be an area where they could tap for, you know, more money.
Yeah.
Or,
I'm sure that they were greedy enough where if it was money from a Jewish family or money from a Gentile family, they probably would come up with some kind of rule or exception. People do that today where they would say, well, hey, this is what we can do in this set of circumstances. But they just were awful, awful folks. And when you find people trying to convert people to what's wrong, Jesus just pulled back both hammers and let them have it. Don?
Well, how would you define the proselyte?
A proselyte would be a convert. When you see that word, just think a convert.
I thought it was convert to Judaism.
Usually, there were two kinds of, they call them converts of the gate. Converts, proselytes, were usually Gentiles who became Jews. But here, based on what Jesus is describing, I'm thinking that he's describing finding Jews who were willing to go ahead and become like the Pharisees and the scribes. Like I say, you could have the point there expressed by Dolores, but I'm inclined to understand it as a reference to bringing Jews into a system that was not convinced, that was not right. Maybe they did both, but in my mind we're dealing with the Jewish people. Anybody else? Well, it's quarter till. If you look ahead a little bit, verses 16 through 22, Jesus is at this point going to refer to blind guides, and this is where